What I love is the sun there, it's unrealistically big. At that size, the sun, that close to the Earth, we'd be living in barren, infinite salt flats. But in this, we can see the sun as we would desire it to be. A huge, golden wonder. And the ship, it's us. Us as a species, mankind. We are sailing towards an impossible sun. It's a kind of... No, wait, I can say this better. So scientifically, we know that matter in the cosmos is in a constant sort of churning back and forth across physical space. Everything is made from everything else, so the substance of stars is literally the same matter that makes up human beings, so that's why... Oh, okay. That's why it's unfinished. Because we're all humans, we're just unrealized stars. With the potential to be fragments of brilliant light. We are the children of the sun, sailing across oceans of time, I suppose, towards our potential.
In 1905, on the eve of revolution, Maxim Gorky wrote a play from his prison cell while a cholera epidemic swept across Russia. At its premiere, the sound of riots on stage triggered panic in an audience on the precipice of world-changing events. More than 100 years later, I approached playwright Matt Minicino to adapt Gorky's eerily prophetic text into a radically new play for our own turbulent times. Children of the Sun follows one night for the Protasovs, a family of liberal elites who want to change the world for the better, living on the fringe of a small Russian town. Pavel, a geneticist on the brink of a world-changing discovery, Yelena, his wife, a budding humanitarian in search of a cause, and Lisa, his compassionate sister, sheltered and shunted aside for her neurodiverse behaviors. Their friends, Lisa's cynical doctor, Chapernoy, his idealistic sister, Melania, and the enigmatic young artist, Vagin, with whom Yelena is having an affair, join them for a dinner to celebrate the dawn of a new Russia, as working-class rioters fill the streets outside and a mysterious illness spreads across their small town. Meanwhile, their overworked maid, Fima, her middle-class lover, Misha, and the Protasovs' handyman, Yegor, are swept up alongside the family in a darkly funny, tense, and timely story in which the characters are faced with the reality that the world they want to make better may not have room for them in it at all. As part of the Gate Studio, an initiative to support the development of new work, we spent a week workshopping the play virtually, on Zoom, with a thrilling international cast of Irish and American actors who've been involved with the development of the play. I sat down with the playwright Matt Minicino to discuss the text and listen to extracts from our week's work.
My name is Mark Atkinson Borull. I'm a theatre director from Ireland and Catalonia. I'm also a bursary artist at the Gate Theatre this year, where I've been developing a new production of Children of the Sun, originally by Maxim Gorky and adapted by the wonderful Matthew Minicino, who's joining us for this conversation. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Mark. As Mark said, my name is Matt Minicino. I am a playwright, adapter, actor, teacher who is United States origin, based currently in Manhattan, New York, and I have adapted Maxim Gorky's 1905 play, Children of the Sun, for a modern audience.
Would you like to say a bit about the original play, Matt?
I'd love to. One of the things that really struck us, sort of, is that Children of the Sun as a play is almost more interesting as a historical artifact than it is as a play. And for how prescient and kind of beautifully it captures the moment in which it exists without actually being a particularly satisfying narrative. Gorky was already a very well-established writer at the time. He was a contemporary of Tolstoy and Chekhov, and one of his masterworks, which is more well-known to Western audiences, The Lower Depths, had already been written a few years ago. He was a prominent Marxist, and he was imprisoned in Petersburg because he was very against the Tsarist regime.
So who are the Children of the Sun?
In this play, the Children of the Sun are the Protasov family, which is Pavel Protasov, who is a doctor in the original 1905 play. He is a chemist. Our adaptation has changed things a little bit. His wife, Yelena, who is your sort of common kind of Chekhovian, similar to Yelena in the Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard. She is a kind of louche bourgeois woman with wealth to spare. She has taken Protasov's artist colleague, Vagin, as her lover, and is sort of retreating very much from the world of the proletariat, and she doesn't really know how to deal with them. She doesn't know how to deal with the help, the underclass members who are the staff at her husband's estate. And the third Protasov is Pavel's sister, Liza, who is a Cassandra figure in the original play. She is afflicted with a kind of Ophelia in Hamlet, a psychological ailment that is never particularly clarified, except that it gives her these epiphanic visions of a future in which there is great change. And she seems to be the only one who is aware of the fact that the change in Russia is also going to mean perhaps the annihilation of this family and the way of life to which her brother and his wife have become accustomed. The Children of the Sun sort of refers to all of the liberal elite, the kind of enlightened left that Gorky would have known intimately and been a part of, the ones who see themselves as part of the change but don't realize what is happening, simmering just below the surface amongst the actual workers and laborers and in the any class, any sort of walk of life that is not their own.
Over the course of the play, a cholera epidemic hits the town, and so suddenly people start dying from this mysterious, unexplained illness. And the people in the village start to try and figure out what it is that has been killing everyone. They band together and start to assume that the only thing that can explain what is causing this illness is this science that's taking place inside the big house that they don't understand and they don't have any access to. So they begin to join the dots and assume that the doctor is causing the sickness across town. Meanwhile, in the big house, the doctor, his wife, his family, and his friends believe that they are doing everything to create a kind of new day in Russia. They're sort of the Silicon Valley-style, optimistic, future-oriented leaders of the world who are, from their privileged position, trying to decide the course of events and what will be good for Russia and what will be good for the general populace. So while they're inside pontificating about what's coming next, they become blind to this burgeoning revolution outside the house. And the play ends in this kind of glorious coup de théâtre where the revolution comes knocking at the front door of the Protasov household and really asks the question of what do you do when revolution comes knocking at your door? This was such a hot-button issue in Russia at the time that in the original premiere in the Moscow Art Theater, at the moment when the mob arrives on stage, people were so nervous that they thought it was a mob assembling outside the theater. Things were so fragile in the fabric of society at that moment that the lead actor had to break character and reassure the audience that no, this mob is part of the staging, is part of the world of the play. But it just goes to show how the play was really being written at a time of great social change. The science in the play is probably the inciting incident of the play. Our scientist Pavel makes a big discovery right at the top of the play. And in this moment, in the first scene here, he's explaining what his discovery means to his friend Melania, who immediately sees the potential social implications for this idea.
If
we know that a bacterium, etc., can alter its own genomic structure, we know ipso facto that the structure can be altered. And that is huge. That is new science. Not only can the genomic structure be changed, but hypothetically the genomic structure can be changed by science, by us.
We can edit people?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes, you get how tremendous this is.
You're saying you figured out how to, this is like the Punnett Squares thing from when we talked on Tuesday. You could really change somebody's traits?
Yes, I mean, essentially.
But that's gotta be Nobel Prize level stuff, Pavel.
That's not really on my mind, but sure, theoretically.
Have you been sending this anywhere? Moscow?
Funny story, but I did send some, I suppose, over-enthusiastic missives to the university in Kiev, and, Vilnius.
Yes!
And naturally, I never heard back from Kiev. They're really into alloys these days, but then I got this very funny letter back from a so-and-so at Vilnius who said, this isn't quite our thing.
But this is world-changing.
Obviously, I think so.
The people you could help. Alloys?
Yeah.
Wait, and Lisa! Oh my God, Lisa! You're saying you could delete the genes that make her have all those episodes and the mood swings
yes, naturally. Of course, right now we're just talking about a theory, which in itself will take years and years to prove, and once it does, maybe 100 years to implement, if that. So I don't really know if we're talking about in our lifetimes, really.
Right, we're talking about horizons.
Yes. Horizons, that's lovely.
Can I see?
See?
See your work?
Oh, sure. Yes. Just come on over. Okay, pop those peepers on the eyepiece. Great. And then you're doing it.
I've been looking at a lot of like catalogs and diagrams and things. Is this one of those new Austro-Hungarian ones?
No. No, this is one of those ones that I have.
Ooh, okay. So, what am I looking at?
Well, now, obviously, this isn't going to be quite as exciting to you, but what you're looking at here, the big globby thing, that's a bacterium, singular of bacteria. It's a cholera bacterium, Vibrio cholerae, and actually, if we just, if we adjust this, you can look closer. So, that's a blood sample from one of my best breeders, named him Nicholas after the Tsar.
Right. Funny.
Thanks. I've been pairing him with different mates and running tests on the offspring of each match. Basically, it all comes down to putting the right two mice together.
What happens if I look closer? Can I look closer, Pavel, if I just...
No. If you get closer than that, it starts to get a little hard to see with this whole thing.
You should get new things. This is new, Pavel, and you should be surrounded by the new.
Well, the new is the new is a bit of a reach for some people, and you know, some days it just seems like everyone has very tiny arms. You know, wow, tiny arms! You can really tell I haven't slept.
No, I got it. I liked it, like little penguins.
God, yeah, like countless little penguins in Vilnius.
In Kiev, making alloys, flapping their little penguin arms to make alloys.
Oh my God, no thumbs, just knocking things over, just...
Stop.
Oh no, I knocked over this beryllium with my thumbless fins. Oh, good. Good thing I have tenure, huh?
Pavel, do you need help with this?
Was the dawn of the 1905 revolution in Russia, which was sort of abortive. It only lasted about a year. It resulted from a incidence of police brutality when the guards of the Tsar fired into a crowd of workers who were marching on the Winter Palace in Petersburg. So Gorky was responding very specifically to the agitation of the times, to this idea of the classes not being able to coexist at this point in the way that they had been for the last 50 years. Something had to change in Russia, and Gorky could tell the way the wind was blowing and wrote a play about a group of upper-class sort of bourgeois who can also sense the sea change. They can sense the tide, but they are otherwise completely ignorant to it. They are blinded by wealth and class and kind of political utopianism, and they don't see that the destructive wave and the wave of seismic shift in the sociopolitics of their world is going to drown them when it arrives at their doorstep.
So a little later in the play, we meet Dr. Japurnoy and Liza, Pavel's sister, who have been in the middle of a essentially a mental health checkup. But as the medical session ends, they start to have more of a conversation as friends, discussing what's going on in each of their lives, but also what's going on politically in Russia at this moment. And Liza, who is kept very sheltered by her family, has an intense interest in what's going on in Moscow and going on in Russia. So she forces Dr. Japurnoy to tell her about what's been happening.
How are you?
Are you asking in a doctory way or in a friend way? Like, how are you? Oh, I'm fine. Keeping busy.
Just, how are you?
Good, I think. You didn't ask about dreams, but the new drops, are giving me very vivid dreams. How are you?
Fine. Keeping busy.
I bet. I was surprised you came over. My brother said there's something happening in town.
Something? Yeah.
Actually, he called it a real clusterfuck. But that's all he said. What did he mean?
Some protests. There's a bug going around too. People have been coming in.
Why are there protests? It's about the Tsar again. I heard Yelena say the workers want to talk about low wages, work hours, but no one wants to talk to them.
I think it's a build-up of little things.
You think? You know. Tell me.
There was a shooting at a protest in Moscow. Police fired into a crowd. So now they're protesting what happened at the other protest. Ugh. I don't keep up with politics. We're all going to die someday.
Oh. Okay. Yeah.
2 days ago, a woman came in with this little schnauzer. A huge gash in its left side from gardening equipment. I told her I don't really do animals anymore. But she was blubbering like a whale, and so I stitched it up, gave it a treat I still had, and she was ecstatic, beaming, glorious. She added a 20% gratuity to the medical bill, and then she went out into the street, with the schnauzer, of course.
Of course.
And I was watching through the window. And she turned round to wave at me. And just, wham.
Wham?
Hmm. A grain cart went right over the schnauzer. Dead in the street. Isn't that funny?
No!
Sorry, not ha-ha funny. Funny on a cosmic level. That woman paid me extra to fix up an animal that was basically minutes from death. Now, by rights, whenever someone comes in and says, oh, I've got this ulcer, oh, I've got migraines, instead of me saying, well, let's fix you right up, what I should be saying is, well, here's a quick fix, but someday you'll die anyway. So maybe don't break the bank on a new diet.
You're a doctor. You shouldn't say things like that to people.
Sorry. You're right.
No, sorry. It's okay. I actually really like it when you say fucked up things. It just means we're a nice team. I wish you were more of an optimist, though. It seems like doctors should be optimists. I could be your optimistic nurse. And you could go in with a patient and be like, well, ma'am, guess I removed your tumour, but ultimately someday the world will end. And I'd be there beside you, and I'd say, but it's okay. because now you have more years left to enjoy pastries, read bad romance novels late at night, meet old friends for coffee. I feel like your patients would appreciate that perspective.
If you want me to be an optimist, Lisa, I could definitely make an effort.
If you know the dog's going to die someday, why do you treat it at all? Why do you treat me if you know I'm going to die someday? At least people with ulcers are maybe going to get better, right? Or die sooner?
I like you more than them.
My brother and Yelena pay you more than them.
Well, that's objectively true, but it's not my reason. My reason is that I like you.
Well, I like you too, Doctor.
So, in our adaptation, we've changed quite a number of things. The play exists somewhat between 1905 Russia and 2020 West in 2021. Matt, would you like to talk a little bit about some of the changes that you've made in this version?
Yes, when Mark originally approached me, a lot of our discourse was sort of about this play in which all of the ideas are so fertile and so juicy, and the relevance of it was sort of screaming out from under the surface. And yet much of the text and the characters are very entrenched in some kind of mores and tropes of the era. So our version really sought to look at it with a 21st century eye and say, how can we pull a lot of these characters into the 21st century while still sort of keeping with Gorky's original setting and the setting of Gorky's own life, which speaks so vividly across a whole century of time and space to us now? How can we modernize some of these issues in a way that is going to be provocative conversation starting? So one of the big changes we've made is Protasov, who in the original is kind of a non-specific chemical scientist, seems he's sort of working on a kind of elixir of life, fountain of youth thing. In this version, he is in the field of genetics, and he's working essentially on what might be called a CRISPR, kind of genetic resplicing of genes to alter the traits of human beings throughout generations, which is a science that would not have been particularly familiar to Gorky's audience, but is vividly familiar to ours. And there's kind of a direct through line, this idea of changing all of humanity for the better, not worrying about the politics of humanity or the particular social shift of empires rising and falling, but the idea that physically, psychologically, cerebrally, and at its core genetically, humanity can be altered for the better in a way that would eliminate the other problems. So we're dealing with a big kind of ethical science issue that complements the idea of how do we change Russia for the better? How do we change the world for the better through revolution, through rebellion, through ousting a corrupt and tyrannical regime? We've also sort of tried to make an effort to really deepen some of these characters from their original selves, mostly by playing on a lot of the things that we see in ourselves and in others about the sort of well-behaved leftists who want big change. Pavel's wife, Yelena, in our version is much more of a kind of philanthropist of perhaps one might say the Gwyneth Paltrow variety, though I like to think that she has a little more compassion than that. But she is experimenting with all of these ways that she believes will genuinely help a community around her and that will sort of reach her wealthy hand kind of down out of her class, down to the lower classes, and she will sort of help them up out of the gutter through her actions. Whether or not those actions and that very ideology is misguided is, of course, up to the audience to decide. We have tried to tie in, as we obviously must, the epidemic of cholera that is in Gorky's original to these ideas of fear, the complexity of reported media, and of course, it hardly needs to be said, our own epidemic, as we really experience for ourselves and hopefully reveal to an audience the ways in which a 1905 play can be almost perfectly, vividly, and to a degree painfully about our present moment.
And isn't it funny how, you know, we've been working on this for several years at this point, and between the epidemic and then the recent Capitol riots in the US, it sort of feels like world events are slightly freakishly following the trajectory of the play. So
it does feel rather like a poem that you didn't realize it was going to rhyme until the rhyme actually came. We started this as we mentioned several years ago. So the seeds of a play about riots, a play about a misunderstood disease that sweeps through a community and becomes a point of paranoia and shifting allegiances, a play about the kind of impotence of the wealthy enlightened left as they figure out how to navigate class struggle. All of that came before the events of the past year. And it's almost like we have Gorky to thank for writing a play that is so kind of perfectly encapsulates those issues. And we have been able to kind of create like a theme in variations where we take just the seeds of his original and really spiral out, rhapsodize into new ideas, possibilities about what the world might look like tomorrow. We also get this through line throughout the play of the relationship between the members of the underclass, between Yegor and Fima, and Yegor and Protasov and Fima. And earlier in the play, Fima, in an attempt to kind of exercise her influence and figure out her standing in the household, informs Dr. Protasov that Yegor has been committing domestic abuse against his wife, Avdotya, that he's been beating her, and she requests that he act on it in some way. Protasov, who is not used to this sort of one-on-one actual confrontation between human beings, sort of awkwardly tries to navigate a dialogue with Yegor about these incidents.
Yegor, hey, your wife, Avdotya, you said she's ill?
Mm-hmm. She's been in bed the whole day.
Such a shame. She's great, your wife. I remember once when Lisa had a particularly severe episode, and didn't she send that apple crumble or tart thing over? I feel like I remember Lisa really, really loving an apple crumble that day, so thank you. Yegor, sorry, can I ask? You don't ever hit her, do you? Avdotya, you don't hit her, right?
Sometimes I do. Yeah. When she's out of line, when we're yelling, we hit each other.
Okay. You know that you can't do that. I mean, we're past that as a species. We're just not living in a time where that sort of behavior is acceptable from men. In 100 years, we're going to look back on behavior like that and think, who are these cavemen? Right, these Neanderthals. You understand that, right? You know that you can't do that. And if you keep doing it, then we're going to have to discuss it.
Yeah, I do know.
Great. Really good to hear.
As the play progresses, Melania, who we meet at the top of the play, has been stewing on what Pavel's scientific discovery could mean for society, for Russia, for her friends, for the people around her. And so at this point in the play, she's sitting with her brother, Dr. Chepernoy, who's a little less future-oriented, a little more traditional, and she's finding a way to pitch this idea to him, trying to sell how Pavel's discovery could be of value in the world. Of course, it gets a little complicated when her pitch inevitably leads to his relationship with Lisa.
Yeah, maybe it'll go well. Maybe everyone will just magically get what they want and stop complaining about the things they can't change. Wouldn't that be so nice?
Since when have things in Russia been nice?
Since never, but don't be such a poop about it. What Pavel discovered, Boris, could give people what they want.
What they want seems pretty loaded and also impossible.
Well, it's like what you do, but more cosmic or something. Immunizing us. Yeah, right. Right. Making us immune to the things that hurt us as a society. What would you get rid of? Boris, if you could send little men with rubber suits down into the pit of your soul and have them scrub away the things you don't like.
That doesn't really work that way, though.
No, but this is how I think it would make sense to people. I think I'd have them remove whatever gene makes couples have arguments in public. Come on.
If they could remove the gene that makes people make uncomfortable, sustained eye contact on public transit.
Yes! Yes! The gene that makes people think a time you set for a coffee date is flexible to within 15 minutes. Now you.
The gene that makes you walk slowly on a narrow sidewalk.
The gene that makes you, go on, you do another one.
The gene that,
anything. You got this.
Makes you think you can sing well, when you obviously can't.
the gene that makes you interrupt people before they've made their point.
The gene that makes you cough at the theater. The gene that makes you try to hide a cough at the theater and then just cough more.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. The gene that makes you ignorant of your own shortcomings. The gene that makes you care how you look when you're dancing.
The gene that makes you unable to enjoy silence.
The gene that makes you sad for no reason. When you just wake up in the morning so heavy, like an anchor dropped out of your back and got stuck and you can't move like that.
I wouldn't, want them to take out my sadness, I think.
I'm not talking about, oh, starving children in the streets. I'm sad about it. That sadness is probably good, but I mean pain that comes from nothing. I have that all the time, and I hate it. You wouldn't want to cure people of that? Like Lisa, isn't that what she has, sort of?
That didn't come from nothing. It came from her. It came from neurons and chromosomes.
Yes, but she could be better. Neurons and chromosomes is what we're talking about.
No, it's infinitely more complicated than this. Herself is built on a foundation of the things wrong with her. Trying to suck those things out of her nature would be more like a bank heist than a treatment. It would leave her psychologically penniless. Having to rebuild an entire personality from
okay,
scratch.
Okay, I got it. Sorry. Sorry, Boris.
Meanwhile, Misha, who, with his father, helped the Protasovs manage their riverfront property where Yelena is planning to have Vagin's art exhibition, proposes to the Protasovs that they use the derelict land for a glassworks that would benefit the local community and populace. He has hopeful plans of bettering the community's existence, but also his own life,
for him and for Fema, with whom he is in love. But after he is rejected by the Protasovs, he speaks to Fema about it, and we discover that she has slightly more complex motives.
Just ask them again later. Now they're thinking about it, at least.
You think they'll say yes? You think if the Tsar is overthrown and Russia collapses, they'll say yes? Or do you think...
That's not going to happen.
Yeah, you haven't been in town. It might. If I try again, if I ask them again, will you wait? Would you wait for me to ask them again?
I have to do dinner. There's six tonight. That's extra time and food allergies.
My offer, what I said, it's still all there. Come and stay with me. I know I said 75 rubles monthly, and I'll follow through.
I'm under contract. My contract is 80 plus the bed and meals. And 75 isn't enough.
But you hate it. You hate this, Fema. I mean, fuck. How much can I
don't hate it. I told the doctor about Yegor today, and he's going to do something. So that's 80 rubles, bed and meals, and they listen to me. Sorry about your dad.
He's past the life expectancy in this town anyway, so frankly, it's a miracle he hasn't just spontaneously died already, just to keep the statistics balanced.
You're horrible sometimes.
This is what he wanted, to live just longer than his father did, to do nothing great and nothing terrible, and be buried in a box of wood just nice enough for the neighbors to say, "Oh, what a lovely coffin, I wish I could be buried in that." And he'll get that. He'll get all of it. It's too bad for me that I'd like a little more. I'd like you.
Please go home, Misha.
Fema.
If your dad dies and you get the business from him, what's your annual?
Oh, I'm horrible, am I?
You don't have to answer.
200 rubles monthly.
Okay. That's not too bad.
At the heart of the play, right in the center, there's this massive dinner scene in which Yelena and Pavel host a group of their friends at the big house, both so that Yelena can make an announcement about the art gallery she's planning to open and also to discuss what's been going on in Russia generally at this moment. The whole first third of the play is leading up to this dinner. And when we arrive here, we get caught in this... the audience gets caught in this moment of crosstalk as all of the characters are suddenly on stage together trying to discuss everything that's been going on and the implications of Pavel's scientific discovery.
Right, what the government intended was never... I mean, it wasn't... The idea of upward mobility for the serfs was always a placebo.
No, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Can I...
fucking enema.
I actually... What's an enema again, Boris?
Oh, it's a rectal injection, usually for bowel cleansing.
Oh, yes, rectal. Okay.
Anyway, it was temporary relief, but it was never meant as
a... Well, yes, I was saying that, but I was also going to say...
Revolutions are inevitable. Political systems are built on an ignorance of their own mortality.
Ooh.
All right, say more.
Has any government ever lasted unchanged for more than a few centuries?
Ancient Egypt, Mesopotamia, the Ottomans?
Okay, sure, but we should still just assume that any empire is sailing towards the rocks, and then the survivors build a new ship from the wreck of the old, and then they sail towards new rocks. Russia is fucked, but it's no more fucked than France was, or Brazil, or...
Well, no, I mean, I agree with you, but I think the problem is that both sides in this case, they don't have a... A sense of,
Perspective, place,
human.
Time.
An enema of the people! Like that play. The play, by Ibsen. Anyway, Carry on. Sorry about that. This is interesting.
Well, this isn't the word that I was looking for, but history. They don't have a sense of history because all this government oppression, lower class pushback, police retaliation, this equation is literally one we have solved over and over. We know semi-definitively by analyzing patterns of events exactly how these variables function together. At best, and this is supremely unlikely, we get a major overhaul in the oligarchy from all this, and then in 50 years or something, it happens again.
Oof, well, that's pretty bleak, isn't it?
No, I haven't finished. I think the thing is that we should be pushing everyone towards and away from this fetishization of sociopolitical upheaval. It is getting society to focus on things that actually do make lasting change.
I agree.
Really?
Stop the presses.
You do?
Well, empires don't last. People don't last.
No, they don't.
So, what matters is love. Art.
I think that you're really onto something here, but I think art, yes, art is great. We love art, but also, and I'm speaking from bias here, but science and invention, the ways in which what did you say? Tangibly, we tangibly impact the course of human life.
Sure, yeah. I'm not gonna argue.
You look like you want to, though, so go ahead, argue away, don't be scared.
Okay, well, with science, everything is replaced. New information replaces old studies. Technology is used to replace people with art. It's about moments. And a moment doesn't get replaced. With art, the moments last.
Fair point. So what you're saying is that artists care about legacy while scientists care about progress.
While the dinner is going on, at a certain point, Yelena sort of flits off to the kitchen where she helps, big air quotes, Fema with making the food, making the salad, and uses it as an opportunity to kind of vent her frustrations and her anxieties about what's going on in the world and try to make a confidant of Fema to figure out if what she, Yelena, is doing for the community is actually going to be meaningful for the people that she's trying to help.
Fema, do you like art? Do you like art? Would you feel like if there was this beautiful space on the outskirts of town where you could just go and be submerged in the beauty and truth of art? They're the same thing, truth and beauty. That's from Keats. And there would be all these things, viscerally, radically illuminating the struggle, quiet, beautiful tragedy of people's lives. Would you feel better? Would you feel changed?
I already know what my life is like, Mom.
Okay. No, yes, yes.
Would a person have to pay to get in?
No, it's a community space, free.
I think a lot of homeless people would go there. A lot of vagrants. They'd sleep there and everything would start to stink. A lot of people would go there for the wrong reasons. A lot of people wouldn't be grateful. A lot of people who end up there would be bad people. Not people who deserve to feel better. People who don't want to be changed. People who will never change. And you'd have this place where they could go and just stay the way they are. Awful. And then die. Would you want that, Mom? I don't think you would.
As the night progresses and the celebratory dinner becomes sort of more debauched, the threat of the real world arrives in the form of Yegor bringing news of the significant advance of the cholera epidemic in town, causing a lot of fatalities, as well as the damage done by the riots. His arrival triggers a number of arguments and interactions that result in a violent physical confrontation, where Dr. Chapernoy gets injured, and as a result, Liza has a hysterical reaction. Chapernoy, with Fema's help, gets Liza out of the situation to safety and tries to calm her down.
Liza, you should rest. I'll take you up to bed.
I'm fine. When I said I feel sick, what I meant was I don't feel human. I'm sorry if that was misleading. I phrased it in a weird way, but that's what I meant. Are you still going to let me help out at your office? Even though I'm not human?
Yes, of course. You are human. Liza, you're so human. The fact that you had actual sympathy for that man, that you showed him compassion, your feelings are deeper than theirs.
Than whose?
And that's not... I don't... You can't be ashamed of that. You should be proud of it. Their hearts are ponds or lakes or fucking puddles, but yours is a huge sea. You shouldn't want to be like them. They should want to be like you.
You're my doctor. You should tell me to get better. I want to get better. There are lots of other people who don't feel human, and I want to be better so I can help them.
You are better.
I think I gave him a good hug. A great hug, if I'm being honest. I could feel him getting softer as I touched him. I thought I was curing him. I thought I was taking away his sadness. After the revolution, after the end of the world and the new Russia, that's what I'll do. I'll take people's sadness away. Do you think that's a good idea, Boris?
I love you.
Oh. What?
I just said I love you.
Okay.
All right. I should have asked first. I was afraid you'd say no.
Oh. Yeah. I would have said no. Kissing is how diseases get transmitted. I don't want you to get sick with what I have.
Liza, I'd love to be like you. Maybe it's not a sickness, maybe it's adaptation. I wish I could feel things the way you do.
No, you don't. You feel things fine.
I don't. I think I don't. When I see a dog get hit by a grain cart, I don't feel anything. I don't think anyone alive today feels anything that they haven't practiced or rehearsed or inherited or stolen. But sometimes when I look at you, I actually do get close. I get close to... I don't know. I love you so much.
That's not allowed. I'm fucked up. You know how fucked up I am.
Yes, yes, you are. I love you because you're fucked up.
That's the most horrible thing I've ever heard. I thought we were friends.
We are. We are friends.
If you were my friend, you wouldn't say you love the one thing about me that has the least to do with me. You wouldn't say that you love a thing I've been... trying to crawl my way out of for my whole life. If you're my friend, you wouldn't love my sadness. a friend would cure me.
There is no cure, you know that.
Can you go out of my room? I'm really sorry, but I do need you to leave. And when you come back again, can you be my doctor and my friend again? And not be in love with me at all, because I think I might hate you if you say that, and I don't want that. I like you, so can you go?
Yeah, sure.
Well, thanks for chatting through this, Matt. We really hope that those of you who are listening will have a chance to see the play in person in the not-too-distant future. But in the meantime, I hope those sections of audio from our week of work here at the Gate give you a sense of what the original play is and where our adaptation is going with it. Yes, is there anything you'd like to add, Matt?
Just that I am really excited about the future of this play, about the general future of theater as it is reacting to all of the complex interworking, interlinking chains of the current world. And we hope that you have enjoyed what you heard and will very soon enjoy what you see.
Children of the Sun was workshopped virtually by the Gate Theatre Creative Studio. It featured the performances of Zara Devlin, Brefni Holohan, Clinton Liberty, Leah Minto, Alex J. Moreno, Rebecca Naomi Jones, Marty Ray, Judith Roddy, and Jefferson White. The workshop featured composition by Lester St. Louis, sound design and editing by Gate associate artist Tom Lane, and visual design by Kimie Nishikawa. The original play was written by Maxim Gorky. It was adapted by Matthew Minicino and directed by me, Mark Atkinson-Borull. Thank you to the Arts Council of Ireland for supporting this workshop. The play has been in development since 2018 and has received developmental support from the Barn Arts Centre, the Samuel Beckett Centre at Trinity College Dublin, and the Irish Repertory Theatre in New York City. Special thanks to Donal McKeaton, Paul Ramsey, Richard Coburn, and Jack Beryl. Stay tuned for updates about the future of Children of the Sun, and for more information about the Gate's work, please visit www.gatetheatre.ie.